Okay, so I work at the Jet Propulsion Lab. I work in the Mars program. And so we're building a new rover to send to Mars. It'll launch in July. It's called Mars 2020, but there's a naming contest. So if you have kids in school, they're able to submit names, and, you know, we'll have some name like Curiosity or something like that for the rover, so we won't call it Mars 2020 anymore. But it's going to collect samples on Mars in the form of these sample tubes, and then a later mission called Mars Sample Return we hope to launch in 2026 to go pick up the samples and bring them back to the Earth. So that's one of the big projects we're doing now at JPL. So I've worked at JPL for, I think, like 38 years, worked on the Cassini Saturn Orbiter, or a number of other programs. So it's been fun. And I've also dabbled a little bit in human exploration, working with the people at Johnson Space Center. And, of course, there's this new push to land U.S. astronauts on the moon by 2024, which is very ambitious. And the idea is to test out vehicles on the moon, and that will help us be ready to go to Mars, which I think is pretty exciting to go to Mars. So, you know, we've been given this directive to land in 2024. The program is called Artemis. And in Congress, you know, there was like a hearing yesterday in the House Space Subcommittee, and you can tell that people in Congress are really focused on Mars. And President Trump tweeted recently about, well, you know, when are we going to go to Mars? So people are very interested in that. And there has been the goal expressed of landing astronauts on Mars by 2023. And so I'll talk a little bit about whether that's feasible or not. There was this report that was done by the Science and Technology Policy Institute. It's an independent analysis providing an assessment. You know, is it really credible to send people to Mars? And they kind of said, well, no, not by 2023, because there's all these challenges here. Large power systems in space for solar electric propulsion, zero boil off cryogenic propellants, making liquid oxygen on the surface of Mars. And so I'll talk about an option to go to Mars by 2023, which actually doesn't do all of these things. So if you don't do these risky things, then maybe it's so we can do it more in the near term. So, you know, what are NASA's plans for going to the moon? Their contracts have been let out now for this thing called the Gateway. And so there's a power and propulsion element which is being built by Maxar, formerly known as Space Systems Loral. It's basically a big communication satellite that's adapted for going to the moon. And then the habitat where astronauts would live in the station around the moon is actually it's a revamped Cygnus space station resupply vehicle, which is companies by companies. And so I think now that's Northrop Grumman owns that thing. And so to go to the moon, there would be smaller rockets that would launch these different elements. So there's an asset vehicle element, and then there's a transfer vehicle element, and then there's a lander vehicle element. Just, one example of what this might be is a Blue Origin's Blue Moon Lander. So these pieces would be put together and assembled at the Gateway. And astronauts would come up to the Gateway in the Orion space capsule launched on the SLS, the Space Launch System. And so here they would transfer into this lander, and the transfer stage would take them down to low lunar orbit, and then the transfer stage would separate. And then the descent stage would land them on the moon, and then when they're done with their mission on the moon, this ascent stage would bring them all the way back up to the Gateway. They transfer back to Orion, and then go back to the Earth and enter the Earth's atmosphere and land in the ocean on a parachute. So it's a fairly complicated system, but what's really driving it is reusability. So
that's all. Simple as that.
Wait till I get to describing heading to the Mars. But one of the things they want to do is to refuel this thing. They want to send up these resupply vehicles with propellant and refuel the ascent vehicle element so they can do the next mission without having to send up a new one of these. But you know, you don't get anything for free, because you have to build this refueling vehicle, and it comes up, and what do you do with the refueling vehicle? Well, you throw it away. So, you know, you always have something that you can't reuse in this business, unless you go to some extreme paradigm like Elon Musk's spaceship, where everything comes back. But that's pretty challenging to do that. So this is NASA's plan to go to the moon, and they actually want to do the first landing by 2024. So these things are on contract, but and they put out a request for proposals for the other elements, and maybe some of you would be part of a proposal team, because these are all commercial entities that are proposing to build these vehicles. So NASA has plans for going to Mars, you know, they would use the gateways and assembly point, and then they would build this this deep space transport, which is basically a big version of that power and propulsion element at the moon, and then a large habitat to keep the crew alive going to Mars and coming back. But it's very challenging, because this is a 500 kilowatt system, and the gateway at the moon is a 60 kilowatt system. The largest system we've built so far for ComSat is like 30 kilowatts. So going from 30 kilowatts to 500 kilowatts is a big jump. The space station just has slightly over 100 kilowatts. So you're talking about solar rays that are much bigger than what's on the space station. So it's very challenging. And then NASA's plans for going to Mars would use one of these solar electric propulsion tubs with the 500 kilowatts of power to bring this lander to Mars. The lander would have an inflatable heat shield, which is being developed by Langley. And then when it lands, it would deploy all these big radiators, and you have to have a power generation system. It would be hundreds of kilowatts, because they plan on making their own liquid oxygen to fuel this thing to take off Mars and to come back to the Earth. So, you know, this is why that Stippy report was skeptical that NASA could do this by 2033, because there's so much stuff to develop. But, you know, some of the things that the gateway would feed into this, like the power propulsion element and the habitat, and then the lunar asset element crew cabin, hopefully you could use the same crew cabin itself for the Mars mission. So that's kind of the feed forward to Mars. There's an independent group called Explore Mars, which actually looked at other options for going to Mars. And so the first group looked at Story Mission. There's another group that looked at a research station on Mars. And then the group three looked at a permanent presence, which is more like what Elon Musk wants to do. So I'll talk about the group one architecture, because I think that's something that's more realistic for near term. And so this would use near term technology systems and avoiding the risks that were pointed out in the Stippy report. So, you know, it doesn't have these things. It doesn't have the high power stuff. It doesn't have cryogenic propellants. It uses the kind of propellants we use now in space, hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide. And it wouldn't use the propellant production on the moon or Mars to do that. We'd minimize the number of new vehicle developments, and then have less complex systems. But the idea is that it would be evolvable to eventually be reusable, to have reusable systems and make propellant on Mars when that becomes feasible. And this could possibly support what we call a short stay landing mission in 2033. 2033 is a unique opportunity, because you can actually go to Mars and come back in a year and a half. Normally it's 2.5 years to do that. But, you know, every 11 years the planets align a certain way, and you can actually do a fast mission. So you know, these are the different elements that would be in the vehicle: Orion, a transit habitat to keep the crew alive, and that would just be for a year and a half for the short mission. And then chemical propulsion stages, which are similar to stages that we currently use in space. And then the lander would actually be a capsule-type lander, kind of similar to what we do now for our JPL Mars missions, but bigger in diameter. So the feed forward here would be the gateway habitat feeding into the transit pad. And then this transfer vehicle element that they would use for the moon missions, you could probably use that as is for these chemical stages, and maybe make some bigger tanks for some of the stages. And then the crew cabin, you could use the same crew cabin for the Mars vehicle. And, you know, right now we're building this Mars 2020 lander at JPL, and that's 4.5 meters in diameter. So this vehicle would be 10 meters in diameter, a little bit more than twice as big, but it would use the same kind of technology, the same kind of heat shield and back shell. And so this is just another view of the lander that we have designed conceptually at JPL that would be based on kind of Mars vehicles that we currently send to Mars. So the way the lander works, it's actually pretty simple. It's just heat shield and rockets. So you know, we enter Mars atmosphere at about 5 kilometers a second. The heat shield slows us down. We do hypersonic air maneuvering to get on our course. Then we jettison the back shell and fire rocket engines. And so this is supersonic retro propulsion. We're actually igniting the rocket going into the airstream at about Mach 3.5. It doesn't say zero on the words. But SpaceX has actually demonstrated this. When they land the Falcon 9 first stage, they actually ignite their engines to slow down, and they're at a regime of dynamic pressure and Mach number at the Earth's atmosphere, which is actually very similar to what we see at Mars. So they've actually proven out that part of the technology, so that's been very helpful. And then jettison the heat shield, come in for a landing, and as we come down here, we use LIDAR to sense the surface, and we've got cameras to do terrain-relative navigation and to avoid obstacles. And so these are actually things that we're demonstrating on Mars 2020. Mars 2020, which launches next July, will actually do much closer to a pinpoint landing. We'll actually use terrain-relative navigation, which is like what cruise missiles use. You know, we look at images of the ground, and the computer figures out where it is and then steers to the spot that you want to land. So that's the key forward. And, you know, in this example of a design for a Mars vehicle, this is fully fueled, so we're not making propellant on Mars, which is actually, I think, a good thing for the astronauts, because if something goes wrong, like one of your six rockets just doesn't work, you can punch out and abort to Mars orbit, which I think would be very important for the first few missions. So looking at the concept for a sortie mission to Mars, and I'll do a long mission, because that's easier to do. So this is a 2.5-year mission. So there'd be a commercial launch that puts this 125-kilowatt set into space with a boost stage, which is a chemical stage, and this would be like a Falcon Heavy or a Blue Origin vehicle. Or it could be a Vulcan, a ULA Vulcan vehicle. And the step tug would take it to high Mars orbit. HMO is high Mars orbit. So that's the first launch 3 years before the people deploy. And then we would actually use aerobraking, which is what we use now to bring satellites to a little orbit around Mars, to get to low Mars orbit, which is where we'll need that boost stage later. Then the Space Launch System would launch this lander, this 10-meter diameter lander, to high Earth orbit, because this weighs 75 tons, and SLS can't send that directly to Mars, but it can send it to higher orbit. Then there would be another SLS launch that would use just the upper stage of the vehicle to dock with this, and there would be enough propellant left in the upper stage to inject that from Mars. And since this has a heat shield, it can use the heat shield to put itself into orbit around Mars non-propulsively, just using Mars' atmosphere to slow you down. And then there's no people in it yet, and so this is in high Mars orbit. Then 1 year before the crew departs, the full Mars stack would be launched with the lower orbit by the SLS, because this weighs about 125 tons. SLS can launch 130 tons to lower orbit. So that's the habitat and these propulsion stages. And then we would use another SLS launch, which doesn't have a payload, it just has one of these upper stages, to dock with this and boost it to higher orbit, which is where you want to be for departing to Mars, because that's a very high energy orbit. Then we would propose using commercial vehicles to deliver this Earth departure stage. There's a number of options for that, because that will be the stage that will actually push the stack out to Mars. And when all this stuff is in place, because there's four launches, everything works, thumbs up, so now you're finally ready to launch the crew, and SLS would send a crew up to higher orbit. It would dock with the system. This Earth departure stage would send it off to Mars. Typical trajectory to Mars is like about 7 months or so. So that would go to Mars, and for the propulsion stage, we'll put it into orbit around Mars, and then it could meet up with this crew lander. And then the crew could transfer to the lander and deorbit and land on the surface of Mars, you know, with the methodology we described earlier. And the first mission would probably be a short stay, maybe 2 weeks or 3 weeks on the surface, because they'd be living out of a small crew cabin, so there's not a lot of room there, and they only have so much food and water and stuff. And then after the surface stay, the Mars ascent vehicle would take them to low Mars orbit, because it's very challenging to have enough propulsion to go all the way back up to high Mars orbit, but it's easier to go to low Mars orbit. And so that's why we position this boost stage here, so they can dock with that boost stage and then transfer back to high Mars orbit. And now they're backed up with their stack that can take them back to the Earth, and they would come back to the Earth and live in the deep space habitat, and then they would enter Earth's atmosphere in the Orion capsule, very much like the Apollo astronauts coming back from the moon. And so, you know, this is a possible approach for a first mission to Mars. And there's 5 SLS launches and then some other commercial launches. So you can see it's pretty complicated, but this is actually one of the simpler ways of going to Mars.
That's a simpler way?
Yeah, that's a simple way of going.
You made it look really easy.
That's right. Well, these are all things that we know how to do, so it's not like a lot of new technology. We're not making propellants on Mars. You don't have nuclear propulsion or anything like that. So now we'll look at a short versus long stay mission. So this will venture rocket science stuff here, so I won't go into all that. But basically, if you have bigger rockets to send you back to the Earth, in 2033 you can do this short stay mission and cut like a year off of your trip time, which would be great for the astronauts for the first trip there, so they wouldn't have to spend so much time in space. So really what we've done is we've just... So this is basically the previous... chart that I showed, and we've added one thing. We've added one more launch, and that's another step to send another propulsion stage into orbit around Mars. And so when they get here, we actually pick up this extra stage, and that gives them extra delta V to get back to the Earth to do the short stay mission. But that's not all. To do the short stay mission, not only do you have to have another propulsion stage, but you have to go by Venus on the way back. And you're going to get a gravity assist from Venus, so you have to deploy a sunshade to protect yourself from the sun, because there's twice the solar insulation in Venus as there is at Earth. So if you can imagine how exciting this would be for the crew, because they'd be the first crew on Mars, they'd be the first people, possibly only people, to ever go by Venus, and it would be a year and a half mission. So, you know, that could be very attractive for 2033.
Where's Elon's red convertible? Is it up here somewhere?
So Elon's red convertible.
I don't think it's going to make Mars, right?
Well, no. It actually is in this elliptical orbit that goes out past Mars, and it comes by just inside the orbit of the Earth, and it just keeps going through that orbit. And people have done calculations to see, well, when is it going to hit Earth or Mars? Not any planet we know. It's just going to continue on. Star man.
You know what's amazing about this illustration you're showing? You know, I'm a numbers guy, right? So I kind of look at things pretty logically. I've always thought that when you go to space or Mars, it's like one rocket, it takes you up there, you get out, you do your thing, and you come back.
Yeah.
I had no idea that it takes like 17 rockets and 19 processes. I had no idea. I literally thought it was a rocket that took you up, you get out, you fly back.
Yes, so this is Elon Musk's concept for going to Mars. That's why he's building this huge spaceship, because... That concept is actually one rocket. It goes up into Earth orbit, but here, once it gets to Earth orbit, its tanks are empty. And so there's 5 other launches and spaceships that come up to Earth orbit to tank it up again. And because it has so much propellant in it, it's a huge rocket. And then when you tank it up with 5 tankers, now it can go to Mars, it can land on Mars, and then when it lands on Mars, the fuel tanks are empty. So for Elon Musk's spaceship to come back, he needs to have infrastructure on Mars with probably a megawatt of nuclear power to convert ice to liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen and refuel his rocket so that it can come back to the Earth. So, you know, so Elon Musk, you know, the plan is, it's a single rocket, and it takes people to Mars, it comes back again, the whole thing lands on Earth, but you have to keep refueling it along the way. And so that's the difficult part of the SpaceX concept with the spaceship is, you have to fuel it in orbit, which is hard but not impossible. But then fueling it on Mars requires a huge infrastructure there to create the propellant for it to be able to come back home. And also, the Starship has needs a very low dry mass fraction. So the weight of the vehicle without the propellant needs to be just it's 6% of the total mass of the vehicle. So it's a very low dry mass fraction. And it also has to include all the heat shield material for it to re-enter its atmosphere. So it's very similar to the old single-stage orbit vehicles.
For this and for the Mars landing, you mentioned 2024 Artemis.
Yeah.
Have astronauts been identified or recruited for this yet?
So there are current astronauts in NASA's astronaut corps who would be the ones that they would pick between to do the 2024 mission. Yeah, to the moon. So those astronauts are already in training, and you know, they haven't selected the crews yet. Yeah.
So speaking of astronauts, what kind of human factors have been done on this kind of confinement for this long of a period of time and,
yeah.
and all those things?
Yeah, so people have lived, probably the closest thing would be the Mir space station. The Russian Mir space station was much smaller than the current International Space Station. And there were a couple of cosmonauts who lived on the Mir space station for over a year. I think one of them was like a year and 2 months or something. So they lived in that confined space, and you know, they got by okay. So you know, there's the psychological aspects of it. But I think a bigger challenge now are some recent experiments that have been done with galactic cosmic radiation. And so with mice, they've shown that if you have a simulated mission to Mars, given a low dose over a long period of time, the mice suffer some cognitive impairments. And so I think one of the important things to do at the gateway, I think the most important thing to do at the gateway is to determine what are the effects of galactic cosmic radiation on humans, you know, for progressively longer periods of time, because that could actually be the showstopper. If it turns out that, you know, for a two and a half year mission to Mars, if the crew is going to become mentally impaired due to radiation in their brains, then going to Mars is probably not practical. But that's another reason to do the short stay mission, because it's a year and a half, so it's much less radiation exposure.
Well, Matt Damon was able to stay up there for 4 years.
Because on the surface of Mars, you don't get as much galactic toxic.
And grow a farm.
Yeah, because Mars, the atmosphere actually does protect you from some of the high energy particles that are from the galactic cosmic radiation. And then Mars provides shielding also. Just like on the Earth, when we don't really get much galactic cosmic radiation. Yeah.
Yeah. So this SpaceX and NASA, do they have a working relationship together?
Yeah, we do. So actually, JPL, we do some consulting for SpaceX. Mm-hmm. Some of it SpaceX has paid for out of their own money, but also NASA has an agreement to help out SpaceX in return for, you know, stuff that they may provide us information on. So we're pretty much aware of what they're doing, and we've helped them identify landing sites on Mars where they can find huge amounts of water ice to try to make all this propellant, you know, that they need to come back from. Yeah. So, looking at this proposed first short-stay mission on Mars, you know, that would be the pathfinder for a continuing series of longer-stay missions on Mars, and we would propose using a separate sky crane cargo lander, just like we land the Curiosity rover in March 2020. We have the sky crane that comes and lowers our rover down on the surface of Mars, and we could send a nice unpressurized rover for the astronauts to use so they could drive around and have some science equipment to work with there. So even though it's a two-week mission, I think we would have a lot of science equipment for them. You know, they would be looking for evidence of past ancient life on Mars and possibly current life on Mars, although that's unlikely. The areas we land in, it's so unlikely there'd be anything alive today, but there might be fossils of life from 3.5 billion years ago when the conditions on Mars were almost identical to the conditions on Earth. But I think that you know, it would be significantly greater in scope than Apollo 17. So sometimes people deride like a short stay mission. Well, it's just flags and footprints, but you know, I think with scientific equipment and spending 2 weeks on the surface, I think these astronauts could actually do a lot more for Mars exploration than we've been able to do with all of our JPL rovers for many years. You know, when you look at the InSight lander with the seismometer that landed last year, is like a robot arm, and it picks up the seismometer and it sets it down on the surface and gets everything all right. I mean, it took like 2 months to get all this stuff in place. There was an astronaut there. The astronaut would walk over, set the seismometer down, get the cable out, and they'd be done in like 30 minutes. So, you know, an astronaut on Mars can do in 30 minutes or an hour what it takes us weeks to do, you know, with our teleoperated rovers on Mars. But, of course, our rovers are much cheaper. So this is sort of another diagram to help explain, you know, how this works. So this would be the lander going to Mars. This is the SLS upper stage boosting it off. There'd be a solar array to deploy during cruise. There'd be an air capture maneuver to use Mars' atmosphere to go into orbit. We would jettison the air capture heat shield. There's another heat shield underneath it for the Mars landing. And it's in high elliptical orbit. And there's no crew yet. And then but when the crew gets there, they transfer into the lander and land on the surface. And then they use the Mars ascent vehicle to come back up again. They rendezvous with that boost stage in low Mars orbit. And go back up to the vehicle in high Mars orbit. So this is coming back off the surface of Mars. boosting up to the high Mars orbit, and then they can transfer to the deep space transport, to the deep space habitat, so that they can get all configured to go back to the Earth. So to do these missions to Mars, you only need six different vehicles to do that in this particular concept. So there's Orion, which is in development, SLS, SEPTUG, and it's not so high powered. It's 125 kilowatts, and that has heritage to the 50 kilowatt gateway system. I think actually it's 60 kilowatts now. Then there's the deep space habitat. That would have heritage to the gateway habitat. The chemical propulsion stages would have heritage to the lunar transfer vehicle element for the Artemis program. And so really the main new thing is the lander, and that's why we tried to come up with a concept which is really just heat shield and rockets, and very similar to what we now build for our Mars lander. But looking to the future, when you have longer stay missions, we could use the same capsule type entry system for Mars to land pressurized rovers, these vehicles we call athletes to carry large cargo around and deploy more infrastructure on the surface, and then we could fit a surface habitat inside one of these landers so they would have a larger area to live in for staying a year or longer on the surface of Mars. And looking at the SLS launches that we need, these are the launches that are currently planned for the Artemis missions, and then there's one for the Europa Clipper that we're building for JPL to go to Europa. So hopefully we'll get an SLS for that. And then for the Mars program, we would have another launch to the moon to test out the deep space habitat. We'd want to test that in lunar orbit before we send a crew to Mars. The first Mars mission would have five SLS launches. That would be a 1 to 2 week surface stay. The next Mars landing would be in 2037, and that would actually have a surface habitat here, so they could stay a year on the surface or longer. And then there would be we would want to continue to have commercial flights to low Earth orbit to train the crews using the Crew Dragon and then the Boeing CST-100 to go to low Earth orbit. And when they'd probably go to the International Space Station and do crew training there. And then there'd be the third Mars landing mission, and then every 4 years there'd be another mission to Mars. And we've actually costed this out. And so the cost to NASA would be similar to what the space station program is now. It's like $3 to $4 billion a year on a sustaining basis to keep doing those missions to Mars. That's in like FY 2018 dollars. So I talked about the galactic cosmic radiation issue. I think that makes the gateway more important as a vehicle to find out really what does the galactic cosmic radiation do to people, because we can't really shield against it. To shield against the GCR would take like meters and meters of shielding material. So, and that's different from a solar flare. When you have a solar flare, those are protons and things coming from the sun, and we can actually shield against that. But the galactic cosmic radiation we can't. So feed forward to Mars, I think I've already talked about some of the feed forward here, trying to design the elements on the moon to be able to feed forward to Mars. And then, importantly, the Mars architecture that you want to build, you want to have that designed to actually utilize the stuff that you developed for the moon. So I think that an early crewed moon landing in 2024 could definitely advance the exploration vehicle development, and I think that could help us into a Mars landing as early as 2033. And then I have some other material there, but any questions? Any more questions? Happy to entertain that. Yes?
I'm wondering if we have information on what other countries are doing with a similar mission. Are we competitive right now on a timeline basis?
So Russia has plans to land people on the moon. I'm skeptical about their ability to do that because the Russians have not been doing well with their space program. They haven't had a successful interplanetary space probe in many decades. And the Soyuz works well. I mean, that's the only way people get to the International Space Station. But you know, they've had a lot of failure recently in their launch vehicles and their satellites. And so I think they may have kind of lost their secret sauce, you know, the people who did all these incredibly impressive things back in the 60s and 70s, they aren't around anymore, and the young people just don't seem to be able to manage the quality control. I think they have great capability, they have great rocket engines and stuff, but I think their big challenge is quality control, and that's the source of their failures. The Chinese plan on landing people on the moon, like around 2030. They've had some delays in their Long March 5 or Long March 6, whatever their big rocket is, and that's like a year behind schedule. So I think we would probably beat the Chinese back to the moon, and nobody other than the U.S. has any realistic aspirations to send people to Mars other than Elon Musk. And so, I bet Elon will launch one of his spaceships, a prototype version, within the next couple of years. Like, I hope that it's successful. I really do. But you know, SpaceX has a long way to go to be able to actually do a crewed mission to the moon or a crewed mission to Mars, because they have to do all this refueling for the vehicle. They have big challenges for the thermal protection system and keeping their dry mass fraction down low enough to where they don't get the performance that they need.
Yeah. The space station that's out of space, mm-hmm. that's, I guess, many parts of the world are involved
in
the World
yeah.
Space Station or
something. Oh, yeah, the ISS.
Yeah. So can't they, as a globe, can't we get multiple countries to get behind one program?
Yeah.
So instead of competing with each other, we have one program. Doesn't the United Nations or IMF or whatever it is, aren't there like global organizations that have a space division that does things like that?
Yeah. So the space station was a great example of cooperation. You know, could we pull that off again? There are issues, you know, these days with dealing with Russia. And with China. Actually, I think China could be a very valuable partner, but because of the current political environment, it's not possible for us to work with them. I mean, Congress has passed a law, so I cannot talk to my counterpart in China. It's against the law for me to do that.
So just talk to them?
Yeah. So if we go to a conference and we're both at the same conference, we can talk, but I have to be careful, very careful about what I say. So I think there's great potential for cooperation, but there would have to be a big sea change politically from the very top to enable that cooperation to happen. But, you know, working with the Europeans and India and the Japanese, those are all quite possible. So when you look at the Mars architecture that I propose, you know, there's that those propulsion stages. Those could all be provided by ESA. You know, so, you know, that could be their contribution, and that would save us, you know, billions of dollars by having them produce those stages. And then some of those commercial launches I showed, those could be ESA launches or Japanese launches and release some of the props. So certainly that's possible. Yeah.
For Scott Kelly, how much information was gained from his year-long exposure to the GCR?
So going to the International Space Station, we're actually inside the Van Allen belts, the radiation belt, so we actually don't get the GCR exposure. So that's why I think it's important to go to the gateway, because right. if you go to lunar orbit, now you're exposed to the galactic cosmic radiation. Right. So you didn't really get information on the GCR from the Kelly experiment. Yeah.
If the GCR, say the GCR does become an issue,
yeah.
and you can't have people exposed yeah. to it, would thoughts be given to developing some kind of almost like a humanoid type robot that could go to Mars?
Possibly. But you know, you have to think about what is it that you want to do on Mars when you get there? And of course, that's what we think about at JPL. We're exploring things on Mars now. And so far for us, humanoid type vehicles have not, we don't think they're the optimal for doing the kind of science that we wanted to do. So it depends on what you want to do. If you want to go over a cliff and look for where water's seeping out, or you want to explore a cave, there are probably other kinds of vehicles that are more optimized for doing that kind of remote exploration.
Okay.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So one quick comment on the international thing, just as far as something to keep in mind is, like, a lot of this type of technology sharing that would be required to do something like that, you got to make sure that you're working with a country that you're happy having all
the
sharing going on.
Right. So. Yes. So it's amazing that, you know, the ITAR exceptions that were made to work with Russia on the International Space Station, and that continues even on today. So there is information shared there. Clearly, there has been some technology that's been transferred to Russia from the U.S., but I don't think they've been able to use it because of the issues I've talked about with their aerospace capabilities and quality control issues. I don't think they've been able to capitalize on any information that they've gotten from us.
Yeah. I think just a lot of this stuff is very military and can be used militarily very easily.
Right, yeah, that's true. And so, again, that's the concern with working with China also. You know, China's gotten most of their space technology from Russia. They bought it from Russia.
Yeah.
The other question I had is on the GCRs again. How much research is being done into trying to find some kind of alternative ways of trying to block that radiation?
Yeah, so we've looked actually a little bit at that at JPL. People have looked at electromagnetic stuff to try to have like a big electromagnet that deflects all the stuff, and that requires so much energy. One thing we've looked at that may be more feasible is electrostatic rather than electromagnetic. By having, a certain charge on your vehicle, you might be able to get some of the other charged particles to go around you. But again, that requires less energy. Those are things we're looking at. But I still think shielding against GCR, it's just a big problem.
Okay. I read somewhere where it talked about outer space police, and it becoming that the space became a division of our military or something. How is these assets that are floating around up there, how do we protect those things? How do we monitor? Do we have like a defense department or space police up there? How do we protect those assets?
Yeah, so there are thousands of objects that are being tracked by NORAD, that orbit the Earth. And anything that's like bigger than this, it's regularly tracked. So NORAD knows where these thousands and thousands of things are. And every now and then, something looks like, well, it may come within half a kilometer of the space station. And a handful of times, the space station's actually done a little burn to change its orbit a little bit to get out of the way so it doesn't get snapped by something. And the debris in Earth orbit is a big problem. And there have been probably two or three cases of satellites that have been hit by debris and wiped out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So there are police up there that, besides...
There aren't any police. There are people watching it.
So it's all remote.
Well, yeah. Right. Yeah. And of course, if you've seen the movie Gravity, that's the hypothesis that there is an orbital collision that made all this debris, and then that debris hit other satellites and they made more debris, and there was a cascading effect that just basically wiped out everything in low Earth orbit. That actually is a plausible scenario as it gets more crowded. So when you look at these new satellite constellations that SpaceX is putting up, which is thousands of small satellites to do internet service for people around the world, they intentionally put those in low Earth orbit so that those orbits will decay within a few years to get rid of the debris problem. You don't want thousands of satellites in an orbit that won't decay in a few years, because then you'll have this orbital debris problem.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I got a question. Would you mind going back to that previous chart on I love that one with all the rockets and years right there.
Oh, yeah.
What an awesome display, right? I'm curious, there are a couple of commercial companies, SpaceX and Boeing, that were trying to do manned flight this year. Obviously, they pushed into next year. Can you speak to where they are and how those two may fit into this?
So what I have here is these commercial lower orbit manned flights. So, we have those vehicles. You're only going to do a mission to Mars like every 4 years, and it's going to be maybe four people. So you've got to train these crews. I think you want to screen crews for different effects, zero G, and how well they can handle being isolated for 2.5 years. So I think you want to train lots of crews. And so I think those vehicles, you want to send lots and lots of astronauts to low Earth orbit and have them stay for a month or two just to train the crews and then kind of screen the crews out.
I see. So is that EM1, EM2? Are those the private companies that
the private companies are all just going to the space station.
Okay, they're just doing that.
Yeah, they're just rotating the crews in and out of them.
Okay. Do you learn anything from those events? Obviously, there's every launch, I'm sure you learn something, but are those seen from JPL and NASA as critical to this roadmap? Or do you just see it as the commercial guys are getting up to speed, everyone's going to space, we'll see Amazon on the moon advertising at some point, right? But, is it seen as those are important milestones in this roadmap in terms of our
The commercial crew has really been important for space station, because we've been paying Russia for 10 years to launch our astronauts to the space station. Right. So the real reason for the commercial crew is just to get our astronauts to the space station.
Okay.
But I think the space station will eventually be retired. And so what do you do with this capability? I think you want to continue that capability to train crews for these interplanetary missions, or even train them for missions to the moon, because you know, even if all we do is keep doing manned missions to the moon, they would only be like once a year at the most, and that's like four people. So, and I think you want to train the crews for that if they're going to stay on the moon a long time. So, I think it's important to maintain that capability. And, you know, eventually there may be a self-sustaining tourist industry. You know, Bigelow wants to build inflatable hotels in low Earth orbit, and so if you get the price down to just like, you know, $1 million to go up and have a long vacation in Earth orbit, there are people who can afford to do that. You know, probably not many of the people in this room, but can afford to do that.
Probably.
Yeah.
Is Blue Origin involved in this at all?
So Blue Origin could be some of these commercial launches that we would have. The vehicle that they're building, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's a reusable vehicle. And the neat thing about the Blue Origin rocket, which they're developing, and hopefully they'll launch in a couple of years, it's 7 meters in diameter, so it has a big payload carrying. Most of the vehicles now have 5 meter payload fairings or less, but the Blue Origin vehicle has a 7 meter fairing. So I think the military is very excited about having that extra capability and larger payloads, and I think that would be very helpful. I mean, I've looked at whether it's possible to launch the landers instead of on the SLS, where they fit on top of the Blue Origin vehicle, and I think that they would. But it would take many launches to get the energy into it to get it off to Mars, whereas the SLS can get it to Mars in 2 launches. If you use the Blue Origin vehicle, it'll probably take like 8 launches just to finally get it to Mars. Yeah. All right, well, it's been fun coming out here and learning what some of you all are doing in Santa Clarita Valley. I had no idea there was that much aerospace here. Yeah.
Indeed. We're excited. So I want to thank Poppy again. So a round of applause.